From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, before an Israeli-Hamas ceasefire unraveled in Gaza, people tried to resupply their homes.
Some of the stores have reopened, some of the restaurants. People are out in the streets. Today, for the first time, I saw children playing in the ocean on the beach.
Australia targets homegrown terrorists. Investigators work on the Malaysian plane crash site in Ukraine. U.S. health officials announce a surge of support for combating Ebola. And a China-backed railway expansion stalls in Myanmar. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. The Israeli military says one of its soldiers may have been captured by militants in the Gaza Strip, where a temporary ceasefire collapsed just hours after it began today. Military officials quoted in Israel media say the alleged abduction occurred in the southern city of Rafah at about 9:30 a.m. local time, an hour and a half after the humanitarian truce between Israel and Hamas took effect. They gave no other details on the incident. Shortly after the time Israel says the attack took place, the Israeli military resumed shelling the southern Gaza Strip, where local officials say at least 27 Palestinians were killed. Militants also resumed firing rockets into southern Israel. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office released a statement blaming Gaza militants for flagrantly violating what was supposed to be a three-day ceasefire. Israeli media reported that the truce had ended and that the military resumed its offensive operations in Gaza. Earlier in the day, before the ceasefire unraveled, people tried to take advantage of the lull in fighting. VOA correspondent Scott Bobb, on the streets of Gaza, spoke to us at that time.
Life is starting to return to normal here a few hours after the ceasefire was declared, the temporary ceasefire. There's actually small traffic jams in the city as people rush out to buy supplies and visit the homes they abandoned days or weeks ago. I'm standing at a gas depot for cooking gas, and there are literally hundreds of canisters lined up waiting to be filled after 3.5 weeks. This is the first depot to reopen. The others are located to the east near the conflict zone and are considered too dangerous to reopen. In addition, one sees some of the shops reopening, even though today is the day of prayer. Some of the stores have reopened, some of the restaurants. People are out in the streets. Today, for the first time, I saw children playing in the ocean on the beach. And fishermen have gone out, although they stay within about 100 meters of shore, but they're trying to fish after 3.5 weeks without work.
How do the residents feel about what's going on?
This is very early, Susan. There is some euphoria just to be able to walk out in the street and feel somewhat safe, but it is tempered because everyone knows this is temporary, so people are very guarded, but they're taking advantage of this time to get out, to restock, resupply, and see who's still alive.
Are they feeling isolated from the international community?
It's almost like they're not thinking about that. They're so busy surviving and staying safe and worrying about how to survive to the next day. They do follow the news. They tend to follow the local news much more closely than anything else. Without electricity, it's hard to follow television newscasts and most radio newscasts they do get, although very few people, once the batteries run out, it's hard to have a radio into working. So it's a bit of a struggle, but they are aware of what's going on, at least in their lives and in their territory, and of course they're still very concerned.
This is also an opportunity for people to bury their dead.
Yes, and perhaps uncover some of the dead, because that's part of the reasons for this, is humanitarian, to allow people to go back and recover any bodies and bury them. Most of those who have been recovered have been buried immediately, but also the hospitals are dealing with a major humanitarian crisis in that they're full, running low on supplies, their staff are exhausted, and for instance, many of them have been using generator power because there's no public electricity. I understand that they're trying to set up a line from Israel into the main hospital, the Shifa Hospital, but it's still very, very difficult, and there have been several urgent calls for assistance on the health front.
What about evacuating some of those injured people? Is there any mention of that?
Well, Israel has set up a field hospital near Erez, its crossing, and it says it is willing to treat Palestinians, but many Palestinians are reluctant to go there. It just has to do with the suspicion and with the strong feelings against Israel because of this violence as a result. So there are some ways to help, but the pipeline just hasn't started up yet, and it's going to take some days, if the ceasefire holds, for it to actually establish itself.
You mentioned that the fishermen are going back out again. What about people escaping by the sea?
Oh, that's impossible. There are half a dozen warships visible on the horizon, the near horizon, and at night they're brightly lit up like Christmas trees. That's impossible, and that's why the fishermen only go out a few hundred meters. They're not going out beyond the port extent, you know, the furthest of the port, because it's extremely dangerous, and they're very afraid. That is not going to happen until there's some sort of agreement whereby Israel allows them to go out a certain distance. They're very strict about watching for that.
Is there any sign at all that Hamas would be willing to stop firing on Israel and that accept a permanent ceasefire? Are there any signs that they might be willing to give up?
I would say there's no sign of that officially as yet. Hamas continues to insist on a complete end to the blockade before it will consider a formal official ceasefire. And Israel insists on the demilitarization of Gaza before it will consider lifting any blockades. At the moment, officially, there is no ceasefire. There are talks supposed to be held today in Cairo between the parties on trying to extend the ceasefire. But I would say we're still a long way off from the kind of scenario you're talking about.
VOA correspondent Scott Bobb speaking with us from the streets of Gaza earlier today, before the ceasefire unraveled. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry on Thursday cautioned that the truce is not permanent, calling it a moment of opportunity. He said the people of Gaza deserve to live in safety and dignity, while Israel's security concerns need to be met. After nearly 4 weeks of fighting, over 1,400 Palestinians have been killed and over 60 Israelis are dead. Australian police have issued arrest warrants for two Australian Islamic State fighters after one of them was pictured online brandishing the severed heads of Syrian government soldiers. Authorities are drafting new laws to combat the rising threat of homegrown extremism in Australia. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The two suspects have been identified by Australian police as Khaled Sharouf and Mohamed Elamar. They're thought to be with the radical Islamic State fighters in Syria. Photographs posted on social media show Elamar holding severed heads in his hands, and he boasts that he would cut the throats of infidels. The two men from Sydney are considered to be the two most notorious Australians fighting with the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq. Neil Gagan, Australia's Deputy Federal Police Commissioner, says the two are now wanted on terrorism-related charges.
Words don't adequately describe how abhorrent those photographs are. I mean, 30 years of policing, it's probably one of the worst things, if not the worst thing I've seen. The Australian government, rightly so, came out very strongly on Friday, criticising in very strongest possible terms the type of behaviour that those two gentlemen are allegedly involved in. I can assure the Australian community that we have current first instance warrants for their arrest, and as soon as they set foot in Australian soil, they'll be taken into custody.
It's understood that Elamar and Sharouf had links to a teenager from the Australian city of Melbourne. Authorities say that 18-year-old Adam Darman blew himself up in Baghdad in a suicide bombing killing five last week. He was questioned by Australia's intelligence agencies before he flew to the Middle East last year. But authorities say they had insufficient powers to stop him from leaving the country. In Canberra, the government is preparing new laws that would make it easier to prosecute terrorism cases. Australia's Attorney General George Brandis says there's a small yet dangerous group of homegrown extremists.
The one thing that no Australian should ever think is that this is a problem that exists on the other side of the world. Because while it might take shape on the other side of the world, the number of Australians who are participating in this war fighting in Syria and Iraq shows that this is a problem that exists and germinates within our suburbs, within the suburbs of Sydney and Melbourne and Brisbane, among a very small number of people, a very, very small number of people. But nevertheless, this is a product which has a domestic germination.
The Australian Security Intelligence Organisation wants greater powers to monitor the phones and emails of terrorism suspects. Its Director General is David Irvine.
We've always been worried about the threat of homegrown terrorism. In the last 10 years, we have actually stopped four mass casualty attacks occurring in Australia when we stopped them quite early in their planning stages.
The government estimates that there are 150 Australians fighting with radical groups overseas. Richard Barrett is a former British diplomat and senior vice president of the strategic intelligence provider, the Sufan Group, which advises governments on security and intelligence matters. He says the concern is that Western fighters in Iraq and Syria will carry out atrocities when they get back home.
There's been a man, a Frenchman, who went back to Europe and killed four people outside the Jewish Museum in Brussels not very long ago. He'd been with the Islamic State, or the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria as it was then, for about a year beforehand. So clearly, even if it's not radicalizing people to that point, their participation in that fight, clearly it's attracting people who could very well commit terrorist acts back in their home countries. And I think that's, you know, it's a very legitimate concern.
Muslim groups in Australia say that organisations such as the Islamic State are winning over young people thanks to slick online propaganda campaigns. The Muslim groups are calling for community leaders to be vigilant in the face of the threat of homegrown extremism. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney, Australia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
Several dozen international investigators have begun working at the crash site of Malaysian Airlines Flight 17 in eastern Ukraine. Investigators from the Netherlands and Australia, along with accompanying officials from the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, today began combing an area now designated as a crime scene. They will focus on recovering several dozen bodies still missing and retrieving the belongings of the 298 people killed when the Boeing 777 was shot down last month. The team of investigators on Thursday managed to reach the crash site for the first time since it was brought down by a missile. Ertugrul Apkan is the chief monitor of the OSCE Special Monitoring Mission to Ukraine.
All parties were responsive in the manner that the international team reached over there, and we count on the arrangements that our team was able to go there each day, every day, in order to carry out this investigation in the upcoming 2 or 3 weeks' time.
Clashes along routes to the wreckage site between government troops and pro-Russian separatist rebels had kept the delegation from reaching the area to retrieve bodies that have been lying in open fields where midsummer temperatures have hovered around 32 degrees Celsius for the last several weeks. Ukraine's deputy prime minister vowed to maintain a safe route leading to the crash site so it can continue to be used to access the embattled region.
Хочу також зазначити, що сьогодні парламент ратифікував угоди, які були підписані за дорученням президента.
Володимир Гройсман also said an agreement ratified in parliament would allow some 700 people, including international investigators and military personnel, to operate on the crash site. U.S. health officials are urging Americans to avoid non-essential travel to the three West African countries facing an Ebola outbreak. As Face Lapidus reports, additional experts are being sent to the area to help the governments of Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea manage the crisis.
Thomas Frieden, director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, addressed what he called the biggest and most complex Ebola outbreak in history, centered along the common border of Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea.
Over the next 30 days, we plan to send an additional 50 CDC disease control specialists into the three countries. These individuals will help countries establish emergency operations centers that can develop a structured and effective way of addressing the outbreak. This is being done in close collaboration with the World Health Organization. They will also help strengthen laboratory networks so testing for the disease can be done rapidly. And third, building the capacity of individuals from within the area to do these functions for this outbreak and future threats as well.
He identified two major challenges those governments face in trying to control the situation.
Many of the health systems in these countries are not highly functional. They may not reach into rural areas. Healthcare workers may not reliably be present at facilities, and facilities may have very limited capacities. Second, in some areas, there has been lack of understanding and hostility or violence against some of the groups that are trying to respond to the outbreaks.
Among the CDC experts headed to the region will be airport screeners to help countries identify travelers who may be sick. Frieden also announced a more urgent travel alert, advising Americans to avoid any non-essential trips to the area. He reviewed three key steps to stop the outbreak: rapidly identifying and isolating patients, finding and following anyone they had contact with over the previous 3 weeks to see if they developed symptoms, providing supportive care and treatment centers, and preventing future cases through education, strict adherence to quarantine protocols, and avoiding the consumption of bushmeat and bats. He compared the effort to fighting forest fires.
If you leave behind even one burning ember, one case undetected, it could reignite the epidemic. So difficult as it is, it can be done. And I'm confident that as we make progress over the coming weeks and months, we will not only begin to tamp down these outbreaks, but leave behind stronger systems that will be able to find, stop before they spread, and prevent more effectively Ebola and other health threats.
Frieden concluded, this is a marathon, not a sprint, warning it will take 3 to 6 months to get the situation under control. Faith Lapidus, VOA News, Washington.
One of the NGOs working in Sierra Leone says containing the Ebola epidemic will require overcoming fear and stigma surrounding the disease. The group ActionAid says the high death rate has caused a lack of faith in the medical system. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The World Health Organization says there have been more than 470 confirmed cases of Ebola in Sierra Leone. There are several hundred more suspected cases. More than 230 people have died. ActionAid country director Mohamed Sila says the major challenge facing Sierra Leone, Guinea, and Liberia is a poor health infrastructure. He says the countries are simply not well equipped to handle the crisis because of a lack of investment in health. Sila says those countries need to act to change that.
First, it has to do with necessary training for the staff, equipping the staff with the basic equipment that they need to actually carry out their work. Issues as simple as an ambulance is a challenge for major hospitals. If you have a suspected case, there are very limited ambulances around to collect the sick people and easily isolate them.
He says many community health centers lack access to electricity. That means no refrigeration to safely store vaccines or drugs that are susceptible to heat. Another major problem is fear, and fear of Ebola is widespread among the population. The ActionAid country director says many people actually deny the existence of the disease and attribute the sickness and death to some other cause. Also, the message that was sent out after the Ebola outbreak was confirmed was that it had no cure. When families did bring their sick relatives to the hospital, patients were immediately placed in quarantine, and the family lost contact with them.
That lack of communication, that lack of clarity brought about the mistrust. People saw the hospitals now as a death zone. What happened in the isolation centers was not very, very clear to the general public.
There have been several incidents in Sierra Leone where families removed infected people from hospitals. Those incidents, Sila says, not only indicate the lack of information families had about the disease, but the lack of security at the health facilities. But what message can be sent when a disease is so often fatal? Sila says it has to do with educating the communities. ActionAid staff and others are going door to door in Sierra Leone doing just that, explaining prevention methods, signs and symptoms, and the importance of taking people to the hospital.
Because we have a long-term presence in the communities, they trust us. They trust the information that we give them.
Local and traditional leaders play a big role in those education efforts. Sila also says there's a lack of testing centers. For example, there are just two in eastern Sierra Leone. One is run by the Ministry of Health and the other by Doctors Without Borders. Some people may have to travel hundreds of kilometers to reach them and then wait 2 or 3 days for the results. It was during that waiting period that families removed patients from health facilities. One thing being done to raise hope among the population is to talk about the people who became infected and survived. ActionAid, the Ministry of Health, and many volunteers are sending the message that medical care gives people a chance of overcoming the disease. And they point to the nearly 130 infected people who have so far. And those survivors are now helping to educate the population through media campaigns.
We are gaining confidence of the people. And what you can even see from the government figures is that the number of people who are reporting to the health center is actually increasing.
Sila is calling for greater international support for Sierra Leone to increase the number of Ebola rapid testing centers. He says this would go a long way toward controlling the outbreak. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Three years ago, China and Myanmar signed an agreement to construct a high-speed rail network that would connect China's Yunnan province to the Bay of Bengal. But last month, the three-year memorandum of understanding expired, leaving the network's future in doubt. Myanmar's railway minister says the project has been abandoned, but Chinese authorities are not giving up. Gabrielle Paluk has details from Bangkok.
Myanmar officials say plans for the $20 billion high-speed railway that would have linked a sleepy seaport in one of Myanmar's poorest states to Kunming, Yunnan's provincial capital, were never realized, and no construction has been started. The train would have run alongside the already completed Shui natural gas pipeline built by the Chinese. A road was to be built as well. Railway Ministry Director Mian Wei said last month the project was canceled because it was the will of the Myanmar people. He said there are no plans to implement this project, and the agreement has expired, so we will no longer carry on the project in accordance with the public's demand. Similar large-scale joint venture projects between China and Myanmar have sparked popular opposition, mostly from the local people who would be affected by the construction. These projects include a mega dam for hydropower on the Myitsone River in Kachin State that appears to have been successfully suspended, and the Chinese-run Lat Padang copper mine in Upper Myanmar. Wang Aung, an activist with the Shui Gas Movement, says canceling large-scale infrastructure projects with the Chinese is a way the nominally civilian government makes a break with the former military government.
When they started to build the pipeline, at the time, there has been a lot of the military operation and a lot of their people being oppressed under the military hunter. So now that we could say that there's kind of the political development under the so-called civilian government under the President Deng Xing. President Deng Xing usually mentioned about the people participation and kind of the democratization, which could create kind of platform for the local people to take part and to voice their concerns.
Chinese Ambassador Yang Holan says the plan has not yet been abandoned by China. In a statement to VOA, he said, China and Myanmar have jointly fulfilled the project's design, and the Chinese side is ready to continue working on the project. He said the project is part of the planned Trans-Asian Railway Network that would link all countries in continental Southeast Asia and Singapore to China by Chinese-built high-speed railways as per an agreement signed in 2009. The project was dubbed the Iron Silk Road by the Chinese government and is intended to bring economic development to resource-rich countries bordering China and allow China access to more ports. Few participating countries have actually acted on the agreement. However, anti-Chinese sentiment is strong in Myanmar. For decades, during the socialist era, deadly anti-Chinese riots flared up regularly. And while Myanmar's Rakhine State is badly in need of development, a special economic zone and planned deep-sea port in Chagpu have not delivered the sorts of basic infrastructure and services that many of Rakhine State's residents need. Wang Aung says he thinks it's unlikely the Chinese-backed project will come to fruition.
This is one of the obvious examples of how local people are being angered against the Chinese project. That's why the railway minister would like to express their concern and try to end the MOU.
A regional rail network through Southeast Asia has been seriously discussed for more than 100 years when British and French colonial rulers sketched out plans for a Kunming to Singapore railway. Since then, governments have routinely discussed the idea, but the plans have repeatedly run into logistical and financial problems. This week, Thailand's military junta announced plans for a $23 billion railway upgrade in Thailand, which would become part of the long-planned regional network. Gabrielle Pollock for VOA News from Bangkok.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On August 1st, 1914, Germany declared war on Russia, siding with Austro-Hungary, just as Russia had mobilized its troops in defense of Serbia. This series of actions followed Austro-Hungary's declaration of war on Serbia, which was sparked by the assassination in Sarajevo of the heir to the Austro-Hungarian throne, Archduke Ferdinand. Austro-Hungary was looking for a quick and limited war, but the treaty alliance system that tied the various European nations to one another's defense served to escalate the conflict into what would become World War I. On August 1, 1894, the first Sino-Japanese War erupted, the result of a dispute over the control of Korea. The principal result was a shift in regional dominance in Asia from China to Japan. On August 1, 1927, the Nanchang Uprising began. It was the first significant battle in the Chinese Civil War between nationalist and communist forces. On this date in 1944, during World War II, an advanced Soviet armored column reached the suburbs of Warsaw, prompting Poles in the city to launch a major uprising against the Nazi occupation. But the Russians failed to come to the aid of the Poles. The Germans destroyed Warsaw and massacred more than 200,000 people. On August 1, 1966, former Marine sniper Charles Whitman targeted and killed 16 people from atop the 100-meter-tall University of Texas Tower in Austin. Many others were wounded during the two-hour shooting spree. Whitman was killed by police. And on this date in 1981, the music video channel MTV made its debut. I'm Dave DeForest with Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States welcomes the release and departure from Sudan of Ms. Maryam Ishag, a Christian who was accused of apostasy and sentenced to death last May. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry thanked the Italian government for its particular role in working with the government of Sudan to secure Ms. Ishag's departure from the country. He also thanked individuals worldwide who had championed her cause. Around the world, supporters of religious freedom celebrate the arrival of Maryam Ishag and her family in Rome, wrote Secretary Kerry in a recent statement. I want to acknowledge the many individuals in the United States and the international community who expressed their concern at Ms. Ishag's plight. Their concerns were our cause. Ms. Ishag recently arrived in Italy and is expected to travel to the United States in the near future, where she and her family will settle. I am especially proud that our diplomatic efforts through the U.S. Embassy in Khartoum helped secure Ms. Ishag's and her family's release, said Secretary Kerry. I extend my personal best wishes as they rebuild their lives and restore hope for a future where all people can live their faiths fully and freely. Freedom of religion is a fundamental human right enshrined in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. The United States will continue to be an unwavering advocate for this right worldwide.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.